find the deal, the money will come. There is truth to that, but there's caveats, right? The assumption there is that you've built an investor pool. Or if you haven't, the assumption is, well, you're going to take it to somebody who has, and now you're going to be giving away either control or equity or something like that.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Andrew Cushman has syndicated over 2,600 value-add apartment units in the last 10 years. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be here, Sam.
Hey, the pleasure's mine. Thanks for coming on today. There's three questions I ask every guest who comes in the show. In 90 seconds or less, can you tell me, where did you start, where are you now, and how did you get there?
Is that 90 seconds for each or 90 seconds total?
Total.
Ooh, geez. All right. Well, I started back in 1977. My dad had a twinkle in his eye. And fast forward a little bit, I was a chemical engineer, quit doing that in 2007 to flip houses full-time in Southern California. That was great, but it was the equivalent of another full-time job.
Right.
And so my wife's a business partner. We wanted to move into something that was more scalable and also provided more recurring income and had the higher probability of building lasting wealth. And so in 2010, we said, hey, everyone just got foreclosed on. And they said, so that means that no one can either can buy a house or wants to buy a house because they're all scared of it. We had a huge recession, which means we're going to be having probably a long expansion. So that rentals should probably do well. So we went and found a guy who'd already done 800 units, hired him as a mentor, did our first syndication in 2011. It was 92 units on the other side of the country in Macon, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And since then, I've been doing it full time and we're somewhere around 2,700 units. So
that's really, really cool. I love just you found something you liked and you stuck with it. Was there ever any temptation along the way to look at other asset classes?
No, not really. I'm a big believer, and there's different theories on this when you're building businesses about having like multiple businesses and diversification. And for us, we found the best thing is try to be really good at one thing. And that's what we're striving to do. I know guys that do multifamily and industrial and self-storage and a bunch of other things. And those are great investments and they've done really well. There's nothing wrong with them at all. Right. I just feel like we know and understand multifamily and I feel like we're getting pretty good at it and we want to just get that much better. So stay focused.
Right. No, I think that's really great. I guess talk to us about this process. You said, hey, we're going to go buy our first 92 units. In 2011, syndication really probably wasn't even a buzzword like it is today. How did you guys take those down?
That was a struggle. That first deal is a big part of why my hair is as gray as it is. And you're right. Syndication wasn't a buzzword. There was no one. Dave Lindahl was like the one guy out there teaching people about apartments. And that was it. There was no one else. There's no billboards in Dallas about how to become an apartment syndicator. And so we had, like I mentioned, we had started flipping houses in Southern California. And so we had some private investors that if we bought a $400,000 condo, I'd go to an investor and be like, hey, give us the money for this. We'll give you an interest rate. And then we'd flip it and do all that, right? And so we went into the apartment world. So that first one, we bought 92 units for $1.2 million out in Macon, Georgia. And for anyone who's looked at a deal today, you say, well, wait, hold on, Andrew. You said something wrong. You said $1.2 million for 92 units. No, that was the price. I think it works out to roughly $7,500 a unit. That's what the market was like in 2011, right? It's either really easy to get money and really hard to get deals, which is kind of today, or it's really easy to get deals and hard to get the funding. That's what it was in 2011. The market was at a bottom, lots of distress, and everyone was scared to death of real estate and no one wanted to touch it. And there was no liquidity and you couldn't get loans on a lot of this stuff. So the pricing reflected that. So $1.2 million, and that included the rehab. The actual purchase price was $699 and the total that we needed is $1.2. And we had our mentor. We were a bit naive in terms of how easy it would be to raise $1.2 million back then. It took us 6 months, just one investor at a time, $10,000 here, $50,000 there. And actually at the end, part of how we got there is we got the seller to carry a $200,000 note so that we could at least get to closing and get it finished. And then we actually raised the last few pieces over the next few months after closing. So it was a brutal process, that first one, but I wouldn't be here if we hadn't done it. So glad we did.
What were some things you feel like you learned in that first process that you could help other people either emulate or avoid?
One of the big questions that you hear is, oh, well, do I get the deal first or do I get the money first? It's both. Work on your deal finding capabilities and your money raising capabilities simultaneously. Don't wait until you have a deal to then start talking to your investors, to potential investors. But then also don't go and get a big pool of investors all excited about investing with you if you don't have anything to ever show them.
Right.
So it's a simultaneous thing. And if you're like, well, but I haven't done the deal, so what do I talk to investors? Then what you do is you look at deals, you analyze them, you put them together, you put together like a little package. And then when you're talking to people, you say, yeah, these are the kind of deals I'm looking at. Right. And you're not going to mislead people and say, oh, I'm buying this deal or anything like that. You just say, you know what? I offered on this one. We didn't get it. But if we had, oh, it would have been a great deal. And I'm looking at lots more like it, right? To be transparent and honest about it. But that's what you do while you're looking at deals. And then when you have one, hey, Sam, good news. Remember that deal that we looked at a month ago? I showed you that I didn't get that was really good. I got another one just like it. And this time they accepted my offer, right? So you build both at the same time.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think that's really valuable because that is, I mean, you hear the find the deal, the money will come, which is nonsense. But I also liked the idea that you said that you have to find the deals as well, because it is. I've been in that season before where you've got loads of investors lined up and you got nothing to give them. And it's like, oh, well, hold tight while we go find something else. It's going to take, if it's 90 days before I bring a deal to you, a lot of those people have already moved.
Yeah. In what you mentioned a minute ago, you hear that a lot. Find the deal, the money will come. There is truth to that, but there's caveats, right? The assumption there is that you've built an investor pool. Or if you haven't, the assumption is, well, you're going to take it to somebody who has, and now you're going to be giving away either control or equity or something like that, right? So yeah, you're right. It's not just a find the deal. It's not like a field of dreams, right? Where everyone just shows up and everything's happy and fun. There's costs and caveats to that. So these days, the deal is the tougher part of it, but you want to scale both at the same time, either on your own or by partnering with the right person.
Absolutely. Things have changed. You're no longer buying 92 units or 96 units for $6,000 a door.
Yeah, those days are long gone. Well, we will not see that again.
I don't think so. I think one, we've printed too much money to see that. And I just think things are very different right now. It's a very competitive market and you guys are paying a lot more, probably adding a zero plus to a lot of what you're buying. If not, gosh, a zero times 1.5, probably. How are you guys finding deals in a competitive market?
So it's kind of gotten a little better now, but for the last couple of years, we're averaging having to look at anywhere from 1 to 200 deals just to buy one. And when I say look at, that means at least put them through a screening process and check things like median income and population growth and all of that. All of our deals, everything we've bought in at least the last 6 years has been off market through a broker, meaning it's a broker that we have a relationship with and that knows what kind of markets and what kind of properties that we like to buy in, and that knows that if they connect us with the seller or owner that they've built a relationship with, that we're not going to make them look bad. But in reality, we're going to have a high probability of being able to put a deal together. And then if we do, actually get it closed. So it's just been nurturing those relationships now over 11 years. But you know, candidly, we've bought three off-market deals from one broker in the last 12 months that I've just met for the first time like 18 months ago, right? So please, the reason I say that is I don't want everyone to hear, oh my gosh, I got to build relationships for 10 years before I get a deal. That's not true. It definitely benefits you over time as you persist with it. But we're finding the best deals because the broker, I get direct calls all the time from people. Everyone tries to circumvent the brokers thinking they're going to get a better deal. You might get one or two, but the brokers, they spend their lives, like all they do is hunt down these owners and build relationships with them. And the good ones know every property. They know the state of every seller, what their intentions are. And the most effective way to do a large number of deals is to leverage the relationships that they've built, right? And one good broker knows every property in your city and can save you and them a whole lot of time. Now that applies, I'd say, especially for 50 units on up. When you start getting to smaller stuff, I'd say between 10 and 50 units, that's where if you want to go direct to seller, I'd say it's a little bit more fragmented and a little bit more mom and pop. And there's probably some more opportunity for deals in that smaller space. But as you move up, good brokers and good broker relationships really is the way to scale. Again, not saying you can't grab a great deal or two the other way, but for any kind of real volume, you want those relationships.
Yeah. And it's certainly, like you said, they devote their lives to this. And this is really, I mean, the brokers control the market, especially when you get into the bigger assets. So that's, you might as well just go straight to the source, save yourself some time. I mean, it takes an incredible amount of time to build the database for an entire city, let alone all the outreach, the cold calling, the whatever your method is to get that far. So you might as well just go straight to the source and go to the brokers on those deals and nurture those relationships. Are there things other than being known as someone that can get a deal done and get it closed that you guys do to make sure that brokers think of you first?
There's a couple things. One is I'm sure everyone's heard this before, but basically, you know, how you do the little things is how you do everything, right? So be consistent and reliable and truthful in all of the little things, right? So if you tell a broker, they send you a property and regardless of whether it's good or you like it or whatever, and you say, oh, cool, they send you a property on Monday. You say, hey, I'll get back to you on Wednesday. Get back to them on Wednesday, right? And maybe life happened and you haven't had a chance to look at the property. On Wednesday, send them an email. Say, oh, hey, thanks for sending this. I'm really sorry I wasn't able to get to it like I thought I would. I'm going to look at it tonight. I'll be in touch tomorrow, right? It's just feedback. Another example is when you look at a property, and this is me most of them, and it doesn't work, don't just delete it and leave the guy hanging. And I've had brokers tell us this over and over again. They appreciate being told no because their job is to find buyers. And if you have all these buyers that have just not answered, that means it's a task for them to follow up with you. And now you're becoming a pain in the butt. Whereas if you just can reply, say, hey, you know what, Sam, thanks for sending me this property. It looks like a good asset, but it's not quite a fit for us because it's a little too old or we don't like this submarket. But again, thanks for the chance to look at it and they're looking forward to the next one, something like that. Just tell them no so they can take you off the list. And they're not looking for you to say yes to everything. They're just looking, are you interested or not? So they can do their service to the owner or the seller. So just the little bits of follow-up go a long way. And then another thing, and that you can do, again, without having to have a huge track record or anything like that, is, in a sense, train them to know exactly what you're looking for, right? And the assumption there is that you know exactly what you're looking for, right? So for us, we want, ideally, properties built between 1990 and 2010 that are 200 units in secondary and tertiary markets in the Southeast United States. Yeah, and then we have certain things about population growth and median income and crime and all that, right? And so the more conversations that we have with brokers about, hey, that's what we're looking for. And so someday when top-notch broker Sam Wilson is out there having lunch with a seller and the seller goes, you know what? Actually, yeah, I think I'm considering actually selling this thing. Sam goes, oh, you know what? You need to talk to Andrew and his group, and because they could be the perfect buyer for this. That's how that off-market deal happens that no one gets to see.
Right.
And like literally we closed 200 units, 173 units in March. That's exactly what happened. The broker was having breakfast with somebody who said, actually, yeah, these guys made me an offer and I think I'm going to take it. He said, no, hold on. Let me call one guy. He actually texted me an hour later. I was over there, met with that seller. May have an offer the next morning and we closed on that property in March, right? So it's about being top of mind, not only because you've built an actual real relationship, but by knowing exactly what you want so that they know exactly what you want. So they can, so they think of you first when that thing shows up. And that applies whether you're looking at industrial or self-storage or multifamily or even duplexes or fourplexes, that principle applies across the board.
I love that. That is some very tangible steps and advice that you've given there on just managing broker relationships and telling us how really we should be interacting with the brokers. Put yourself in a position where they think of you first. Are there things that you guys are doing outside of competing on price that makes your offers get accepted over somebody else?
Yeah, we've never won on price. If I do, I get nervous. Oh, I would, if we did, I would get nervous. So how do we win without winning on price? Number one is kind of what we're just talking about is we just don't get into bidding situations where we're up against 20 other people and all this kind of thing. So, but whether you're doing it off market, not as I should mention too, just because it's off market doesn't mean there's zero competition, right? There's other guys just like you who are doing the same thing. And so there may be two or three or four other offers, even though it's not listed or marketed. So other ways to stand out. Number one, larger deposits. If most people are giving a $50,000 deposit, maybe you put 100 or 75. The other, another thing you can do, and again, kind of relating to the deposit, is hard money, which basically means once you make that deposit, it's not refundable. Like you have to be certain that you want to close on that property, right? So you can't come back 30 days later and be like, you know what? The roofs don't look that good. We don't want to buy this. Well, okay, great. But they're keeping your deposit, right? So that hard money gives the seller comfort that you really are going to close and you're committed to closing. Another thing we'll do is we provide just a really short, like 3-sentence bio at the bottom of our letter of intent, which is our offer, that this kind of says who we are, and we adjust that to the property that we're buying. So, for example, if we're buying a property in the Florida Panhandle, we might say, oh, yeah, we've done 2,600 units, blah, 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 including recently acquiring and, you know, 400 units in this. So it's like, oh, these guys just bought 400 units here. Oh, well, okay, well, they're in the market. They understand. They close. They can perform, et cetera. We'll also provide references, meaning other brokers that we've closed deals with, loan brokers that we've closed loans with, so that we can say, so the seller can be like, oh, okay, well, these guys just closed the loan with this company. And I'll actually give you a perfect example. We're in the process of selling two properties. And the guy that we accepted his offer, he did that. And when I looked at his references, I personally knew the two brokers he put as references. I'm like, oh, all right. I can call these guys and talk to them. And if he's working with these two brokers, then I know he's a legitimate guy.
Right.
Because I know those brokers, right? So just that extra level, did that one thing win him the deal? No. But it was an extra comfort point, like, oh, all right. Well, he's working with these guys. I've worked with these guys. He's clearly knows some people and has been doing things. So those are some of the ways that you can do it. Also, have your financing arranged in advance as much as possible.
That is some excellent points. I appreciate that. That, like you said, there are larger deposits. You can go hard on your money early on. You can have a short bio and a letter of intent. You can have references to other deals you've done and other brokers, as well as talking, even in that short bio, talking about putting maybe the deals that you've closed nearby the ones that you're looking at there. I think those are some excellent, excellent things to really keep in mind as we put offers out there. Tell me about this. You are going on a pretty big adventure here, I think, sometime this year. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing. It sounds a little bit risky to guys like me, but tell us about that, why you're doing it, and then how you view that from a risk-adjusted perspective, and then how you relate that back to multifamily.
Let's see. Well, yeah, I love to do backcountry skiing, which means I've got one particular friend I do it with a lot, but I never do it alone. But what that means is instead of going to a ski area and buying a lift ticket, we just drive around the Western U.S., and find really cool looking mountains in the Tetons or the Sierras or wherever and say, hey, it'd be fun to ski that. So let's climb it and then we'll ski down. And we've been doing that for 20 something years around the Western U.S. We've done it in Alaska, and we are going to go do that in Antarctica. Spend some time on the Antarctic Peninsula, climbing mountains and skiing them down there. No, and we're not doing it alone. It's not just me and my buddy. Like, hey, let's figure out how to get to Antarctica and die in a crevasse or something. We are going with people who actually know what they're doing. But yeah, really looking forward to doing that. And it's exciting and stepping a little bit outside the comfort zone. I don't know how I'm going to, you know, get across the Drake Passage without throwing up because I get seasick. So not looking forward to that. But yeah, I guess relating back to multifamily, one, it can be pretty scary to make a jump from doing fourplexes or 10 units to 100 or 200. So it's a bit of a jump to go from climbing a mountain 2 hours from my house to going to the literal ends of the earth to climb stuff that you're days away from any kind of assistance. And then actually, now that I think about it, it might be a business trip because the other people there might make for good investors. So
That's absolutely awesome. What are some, other than going along with people that know what they're doing, what are some other things you're doing on this trip to kind of mitigate risk?
Preparation. I mean, I try to be fairly physically fit, as just in general, always have, but we're making it an extra effort to be in as fine-tuned condition as possible before we go down there. And so be in as healthy condition as possible. Also, I'm having all my gear tuned up and going through it and making sure it's in good shape so we don't have any gear failures out in the middle of nowhere. And also relating to business, you know, I've been really fortunate. This is something I did too late, but 3 years ago, I finally started building a bigger team around me and our business. And we've had our successes multiplied because we've been fortunate. We've got some amazing people that have joined us. So this is also a good forcing factor for making sure that if Andrew's off the grid for 10 days or whatever, that everything runs smoothly without me. So this has been a good catalyst to push forward on that, because one of my flaws is a lot of times it's just quicker for me to just get something done instead of take the time to build a system so somebody else can do it. And many times there's other people who would love to do it and want to do it, right? But I'm always like, well, it's just faster if I just handle this. Well, maybe at the moment it's faster, but not in the long term.
That, yeah, I heard building systems is never fun. Like, I think it's fun to get something checked off the list, but it's also not scalable. So without building systems, there's no scale. So that's absolutely awesome. Andrew, thanks for taking the time to come on the show today. Best of luck on your trip in Antarctica. I can't wait to follow along and see how that trip shakes out. It sounds absolutely amazing. You've given us some awesome things to think about in immediate ways that we can some of these very hands-on approaches in our business. So appreciate you taking the time to come on today. If our listeners want to get in touch with you or learn more about you, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah, just Google Vantage Point Acquisitions. The website is vpacq.com. There's a bunch of tabs on there for how to get connected with us. I mean, I'm on Bigger Pockets and LinkedIn and all that stuff, but just going to the website is probably the best way.
Awesome. Andrew, thank you for your time today. Certainly appreciate it.
All right. Take care, Sam. Good talking with you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.